Welcome in Entreprendre dans la mode, the podcast for fashion actors and entrepreneurs. I am Adrien Garcia, I am designer, and every week I am interviewing leading figures of the fashion industry to understand their pathway, their questions, and their strategies to innovate and to develop their business. The podcast is available on every platform. Subscribe to it to not miss any episode. Please enjoy the conversation. Hello everybody, thank you for listening Entreprendre dans la mode, and today we are with Whitney Bromberg-Hawkins from Flowerbox. Hello Whitney.
Hi, it's so great to be here. Bonjour.
Bonjour. To begin with, usually I ask my guests to present themselves. Could you present yourself first of all?
Yeah. Sure, I'm Whitney Bromberg-Hawkins. I'm from Dallas, Texas. I live in London. I started Flowerbox, which is an online flower delivery company, in London 4 years ago.
Perfect.
We're now available in 21 countries across Europe, and we launched in New York in May of this year.
Amazing. My second question usually is, could you please come back on your pathway from the very beginning, from your childhood up to the beginning of your business?
Gosh, that's a big question.
That's a big question.
So I was born in Dallas, Texas. Yeah. I dreamt of moving to Paris from a very young age. I wanted to be like Jackie Kennedy. I read that she moved to Paris and worked for French Vogue. So from like 12 years old, I wanted to move to Paris and work for French Vogue.
But you grew up in Texas.
I grew up in Dallas, but I never felt like I belonged in Dallas.
Really?
I always felt like there was somewhere better for me.
But your parents are American.
My parents are American.
They were born there as well?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, very American. But I came to Europe when I was 12 for the first time with my mom, and it changed everything. Okay. I was like, this is where I belong. So the whole next sort of 6 or 7 years were how to come to Europe. Mm-hmm. And then I graduated from school in New York. I went to Columbia University, and my grandparents gave me a check for my graduation. And okay. I was like, that's it. I'm moving to Paris.
And what did you study?
I studied French literature.
Oh, you really wanted to go there. Okay, French literature. And when you were growing up, except going in France or going in Europe, what you wanted to do?
I wanted to work in fashion. From a very young age, I wanted to work in beauty and in fashion.
Yeah. What was your projection about this?
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, usually people, you know, when they are growing, when they're a child, they think that working in fashion is like this, you know, it's like drinking champagne and.
No, I just loved the sort of transformative power of clothes. Yeah. I loved the way that it's sort of this fantasy, this sort of item of beauty that could actually make your life sort of enhance the quality of your life. And funnily, you know, working in flowers now, it's not dissimilar to fashion. It's the same thing. None are extremely necessary, but the quality and beauty that they add to your life is
amazing.
Yes, really, it is necessary to me.
Okay. So you arrived in France, in Paris?
Yes.
Okay. And what did you do?
So I looked for a job for like 3 or 4 months in fashion. Vogue did not want to hire me, even though that was my plan. Well, they just didn't have an opportunity. And I was just about to have to go back to America because I was out of money and I didn't have papers, so no one would hire me. And I get a call from a friend who said that Tom Ford was looking for an assistant. So this was at the moment when Tom was like the Gucci, it was 1998, the heyday of Gucci. You know, he had just done the white dress. He had done those amazing red velvet tuxedo that Gwyneth Paltrow wore and Madonna. I mean, it was like the moment. I had all of his advertising campaigns hung up on my dormitory wall. I was obsessed with Tom, and he was Texan like me. So he was looking for an assistant, and I applied for the job. I met with him and I got the job.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, and then that began. It was my dream come true. It was the best moment of my life at the time.
Can you explain us exactly what happened? No, I mean, maybe this is quite a few years ago. You don't remember exactly everything, but I think that's very important. How did this guy introduce you to Tom Ford and to this to the company, to Gucci at the time? And explain us. Or was it, you know, when you met with Tom Ford himself, it was maybe something completely crazy, no?
So it wasn't a guy who introduced me to Tom. It was a girl called Gaëlle Desauvages. And I had done a stage at the magazine L'Officiel 1 year in college.
Okay.
And Gaëlle had done a stage with me at L'Officiel. We were sort of 18 at school. We were doing a stage. And she had gotten a job working for Christina Malgara at Gucci in the press office. So I was about to go home. I was totally demoralized. I had called everyone I ever met in Paris. No one had any job for me. And I called Gail, just remembered. We hadn't spoken in probably 2 years. And I said, do you know anything? She's like, listen, Tom Ford is looking for an assistant at Gucci. So it was very lucky, you know. And then I met with Tom, and obviously I spoke fluent French at the time. I was from Texas. I was definitely qualified for the job.
Because you were from Texas.
Yes, I had the Texas qualification. No, and we just really hit it off. I also, you know, have a very strong work ethic. I think he appreciated that. I was in that office every morning at 7. I left the office every night at 10. I never wanted to leave. It was like my dream come true.
What does it look like to be the assistant of Tom Ford?
Well, at the beginning, it was very much like getting his lunch. But at that time, what was really interesting was there was no email. So everything every bit of correspondence he did, he would dictate to me. So there's no better way to understand someone and to be in their head than to hear every way he communicated with the outside world. But that, as we grew together, and I ended up, I was the senior vice president of communications for Tom Ford globally. So I left Gucci with him. But you really learn, there's no better way to get into someone's head and to understand what they're thinking than to spend 24 hours a day with them to hear every thought that's going on in their brain. So it became like I could almost answer questions for him. And I had this really great sort of understanding of him as a person.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how does he think?
He thinks he's very practical. You know, he doesn't have a lot. There's not a lot of fluff and not a lot of nonsense. He's very matter of fact. He's very direct. He's very kind. He's got an excellent sense of humor. These were just all the things I sort of got to understand spending so much time together. And at that point, we were doing a week in Paris at Saint Laurent, and then the next week in Gucci in London, the next week in Paris Saint Laurent. So I had an apartment in Paris, an apartment in London, was traveling back and forth with Tom on the Eurostar every week. So it was like just, there's no way you could get to know someone that intimately now.
Yeah. And what did you learn? What did you apply with learning to this experience? Sorry.
I learned the importance of hard work because I've never met anyone who works harder than Tom does. I learned the power of a brand and how important it is to guard that brand and to protect the brand and not sort of overexpose a brand. I learned about kindness and about keeping good people. I learned, you know, and protecting people that are important to you. I learned.
And how do you do that? That's so important what you are telling that.
I think recognizing people that are great and keeping them close, like incentivizing them, bringing them in, you know, because I worked for Tom for 20 years. Almost my husband's been there for 20, almost 22 years. He's the SVP of menswear for Tom Ford. But, you know, the way you hold on to valuable people is recognizing them. You reward them. You let them grow. Because I think, you know, I started out as his PA. I ended up as the SVP of communications. So I think you have to let people grow as you grow. And I apply all of those daily to what I'm doing at Flower Box.
Of course. So can you carry on the story, you know?
So I made the really difficult decision because I had the perfect job, really. There was not anything about my life that I didn't like. However, I just, in my mind, you know, Tom always said to me, you have to have a 10-year plan. It's so important to have a 10-year plan. So in my 20s, my 10-year plan was to work, build my career. You know, in my 30s, my 10-year plan was I wanted to have a family and to obviously grow my career. And then I was turning 40 and I thought, like, is my 10-year plan to do PR for the next 10 years? Is that really where I see myself when I'm turning 50? And it wasn't. So that, I think that coupled with the fact that I was pregnant with my third child. So that was sort of a life-changing thing too. I had this idea. It was a confluence of those things. I had this idea of an online flower brand and an international global flower brand. So I think all of those three things together made me think it's now or never. I'm either going to do it or I'm never doing it.
And do you remember this time when you took the decision, okay, I go for it?
I did. I thought I was going to do both for a while. I thought I could start this business on the side. Mm. And then after 2 or 3 months, it became very clear the business had a huge potential.
Yeah.
And I found myself more excited by the business than I did by my job. So I was like, and I was having the baby. So I was like, this is the time.
Okay. So what did you start with?
I started with the idea.
Yeah. So what was the idea, the original idea? And how did it evolve to what it is today?
Great question. So the original idea was I was a working mom. I was going, I wanted to have flowers in my house. I didn't want to go to a florist and spend way too much money on flowers for my house. So I found myself going to the Covent Garden Flower Market before work, which is like going to Rungis, which is lovely if you have time. If you don't have time, it's like, why? I was ordering my clothes online. I was ordering my groceries online. I was ordering my beauty online. And I was like, how come you can't buy flowers in a really simple, really chic, really consistent, not fancy way online? Mm. I also noticed working for Tom that everyone really fabulous in the world that was sending him flowers was sending really simple single stem bunches of flowers. So Miuccia Prada would send him flowers and it was 50 pale pink roses, or Karl Lagerfeld would send him flowers and it was white orchids, all simple. It was never a mixed champêtre bouquet that, like, is, you know, that so many florists do.
Yeah.
Anna Wintour would send white roses. So all of these, and Calvin Klein would send white calla lilies, and they all had their signature.
Oh, really?
Yeah, of sort of what they would send. And they were always simple and they were always, you know, not fussy, not a lot of greenery. So I thought, how come we don't just create a brand of flowers whereby you know exactly what you're sending? You're sending something consistent, chic, simple. It's all about, you know, consistent ribbon, consistent, beautiful quality flowers. Mm. And I wanted to create something that was international so that people like us who are international people, if you want to send to a friend in Lyon or you want to send to your your colleague in New York, that you can go to one brand and you know that you're sending a consistent, beautiful, branded product.
Mm. Oh my goodness. So Vidi is very good, but...
Well, I wanted an alternative to Interflora, because if you send Interflora, you know it's going to be terrible.
In the local florist, right?
Or Interflora.
Yeah, Interflora, but Interflora is like
a
network. They use the locals.
Exactly. And what I wanted to do was create the opposite of that, where you could send something internationally and you could know it would be beautiful.
Yeah.
And that didn't exist.
Okay.
And now it does.
Now it does, thanks to you. Thank you so much, Whitney. So once you've got the idea, I mean, having the idea is, well, this is very difficult, but implementing it.
Yes.
What do you start with? I mean,
we start with an idea, and it was very clear how I wanted it to function. And then it was understanding, obviously, going multiple trips to Holland, understanding where flowers come from.
Or does it grow?
Where is it sourced? Everything's in Europe is sourced from Holland, which makes it easier because they do that part of the work
but
for
you. They don't grow everything in Holland, right?
They don't grow everything, but the biggest flower auction in the world is in Holland. So they sell everything. They have relationships with all the growers in the world and they sell all the flowers in the world.
Okay. Can you explain us a little bit? Because usually, you know, entreprendre dans la mode is about fashion. And I mean, we've been through a lot of case study into entreprendre dans la mode, but the flower market. Recently, I interviewed Debeaulieu, I interviewed Désiré Fleur, etc. But I would like to have your point of view. How does it work, the flower market? Because when you talk about your idea, about delivering amazing flowers all over the world in a consistent way, what does the flower market looks like today? Can you give us an overview?
I mean, the flower market is, for me, it's a market that hasn't been disrupted in a very, very, I mean, ever, really.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that just exists the way it does because it does.
Mm.
And I think part of my job is to keep questioning why things exist the way they do. And that, I think, is how you create a disruptive business. What I did, first of all, was we don't have a flower shop. Right. Most florists have a flower shop.
So you didn't want one?
No, I definitely did not want one. We also have an inventoryless model. So you order flowers today before noon. You receive them. We receive them in our warehouse in La Courneuve. We receive them in the morning. We like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. We recondition them, repackage them, send them to you tomorrow. So literally they can't be fresher because they haven't sat for 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
What you're also not paying for is waste, because we have no waste. Mm. And usually part of the reason flowers are expensive is because you're paying for what the florist has to waste. You're also paying for the beautiful little flower shop on the side of the road. So you're not paying for any of that. It's completely stripped out and it's on demand.
So first of things, the first thing you've done, you've got the idea. You set up the logistic. You've been to Holland to understand how does it work, how do you source them. You bought the plants in Paris. Your logistic platform, right? In La Courneuve.
Yep. Well, in London, it's in Park Royal. It's basically an industrial estate. So we have one in Paris, one in London, one in Long Island City in New York, and one in Holland.
So you've got your platform everywhere in the world.
Where? We have operational facilities in those places.
Okay.
And we have a website. We have a French website, a German website, a US website, a UK website, and a Euro website.
Sorry, I really want to dig into the comment, the how you did it. So you've got the idea.
We started in London, though. You have to start small and understand what you're doing. And there were a lot of learnings that first year.
So at the very beginning, what was the financial side of this business? Did you put your own money in it?
Put my own money in it.
Yeah.
Yep. And I have a business partner who also put his own money into it.
Okay.
It became very clear there was an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It also became clear if we wanted to seize the opportunity, we would need outside capital.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, it was upgrading our website to the point where we could have multi-international shops, but that wasn't tens of thousands, it was hundreds of thousands. So there were things that got to the point where I wasn't going to put my own money in.
Yeah, if you want to go big, you need a lot of investment. Yeah.
So Natalie Massenet, who is, founder of Net-a-Porter, she was a customer and a friend. And she, early on, she's like, this is big. This is going to be big. If you need to raise money, come to me. So of course, after 8 or 9 months, I realized it did have potential. Yeah. I was very embarrassed because I think women, first of all, are embarrassed to ask for money. It was also just, I'd never done it before. So I didn't realize I was also giving her an opportunity to be part of something really exciting.
Yeah.
So she came on board as an investor, Carmen Bousquet, who was an early investor in Net-a-Porter and also an investor in Moda and so many, extraordinaire. Amazing, yeah. She was an early investor and she's become
a interviewer, definitely.
You do interview her.
I have to.
She's become a really great friend, mentor, just the best. So she and Mark Seba, who was the CEO of Net-a-Porter for many, many years, and he became our chairman. So Natalie brought these terrific people on board as early investors, which really...
That's smart money.
Yeah, it was smart money and kind money and supportive money and everything.
Yeah.
They got it. They got it. They believed in it. They have from the beginning. So,
So at the very beginning, in this pioneer phase, which is, I think, the most exciting. Well, you will tell me after what. But you were making your own bouquet?
No, we had a packer.
Okay.
Because it was also, I had a tiny baby. I mean, tiny in month old baby. Yeah. So there was and the flowers, they come at 3:34 in the morning. So there was a packer who was there to receive the flowers and condition them and package them.
Okay. And what did you learn the very first week, the first order? Do you remember your first order?
Great question. No, I remember the first day and being, it wasn't 5 orders. It was 25 or 30. And I was oh my gosh, yes. And it was, a lot of it was friends. But what was also really great is that flowers really lend themselves to being posted. Mm. Obviously on Instagram, because they're a very beautiful product. And when you have beautiful product and you have beautiful branding,
you want to share it.
So I've never, ever, ever in my life asked anyone to post something. I find that so embarrassing. But people just did, which was so nice. So all of a sudden we had a business. Really in the first month, I was wow, this really does have legs.
So, yeah.
And it was all, none of it was advertising. It was all just sort of friends who liked what they saw.
Okay, so and what was going on in your head? I mean, when it's working light, I'm going through this kind of things right now. Yeah, I'm starting my business. I'm launching a brand named Réuni, and we are launching. We are on pre-order only, and the first day we sold 200 sweater. That was
amazing.
Crazy.
Oh, I want to check it out.
Yeah, it was completely crazy, and I was telling to myself, oh my god, I know half of those people, but come on, people are putting 130 euros into a big winter sweater. That's crazy. That's a lot of money. And I can imagine you, it was exactly the same. You know, they were ordering like big bouquet, sending them all over the world. At the very beginning, you were sending only in London.
Only London. Okay. Yeah. And then we expanded nationally across the UK. So that was the next step.
Okay.
Then we did Paris. Or we started in Paris and France. So all of France.
So that was back in what year?
That was the third year in we launched in France. So that was last year. A little over a year ago.
Okay.
But in my mind, you know, I think there's a lot of differing opinions. Some people are think, you know, just focus on the UK. You know, there are however many millions of people in London. Why are you expanding so fast? Why don't you grow the market where you are? But in my mind, the international component was always key to what we were doing. Mm. The fact that I wanted to be able to send to my mother-in-law in Tunbridge Wells instead of sending her ugly Mother's Day bouquets every year. And I wanted to be able to send to... Mm. You know, my best friend in Paris. The international component was always key to what we were doing. And I'm so glad that I've sort of pushed ahead with that.
Yeah. One of the questions I always ask is, you know, preparing the launch in terms of communication. Your whole career was into communication. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how do you make the buzz? You said already that people were sharing the flowers very easily, very quickly, because this is beautiful. When it's beautiful, you want to share it on your Instagram account. But when you orchestrate the launch of a brand, of your business, what did you do? Because I mean, you've got a lot of networking, of course, in the press, etc. Did you use it, or that was selling just like that?
At the beginning, I didn't want to put too much energy into growing into the press because there were so many things to make work. Mm. You know what I mean? There were so many things. I didn't want it to, the first month or two, I was like, we have as much as we can handle. Do you know what I mean? We needed to get the mechanics right before we actually went big. Then luckily, yes, I am so grateful. All of my contacts, I didn't know, you know, when you work for someone like Tom for 20 years, you don't know how much of your relationships are friends with you because you're the door to Tom, or if they actually really liked me. Oh, yeah. And what was so amazing, and honestly, the nicest part about leaving Tom and launching my own business is they all were my friends. They all got so behind me. It wasn't because of Tom. It was because they believed in me. And, you know, I remember the first, so Evening Standard did a big piece, which is a weekly, really big magazine that's free in London. So it's given everywhere in the subways and everything. They did a huge piece. My friend Laura Weir did that. And then Vogue did a huge piece where I wrote about the difference from working, like going, what I wore different from going from fashion to flowers. Mm. And it just it snowballed. It was really great. So I'm very grateful to my friends in the press and these relationships I worked for 20 years, you know?
So you didn't, there was not much plan in terms of communication.
No, and I didn't have any money. I just did what I know, which is, you know, if I could do it for someone else, of course I can do it for myself.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. But you sent communiqué press, you sent that kind of press release.
We did send a very basic press release. Yes, we did.
Okay.
And I, of course, had a great sort of network of people to send that to.
Okay. And in terms of growth, what is working actually? The good old word of mouth, or do you advertise on Facebook and on that kind of stuff?
It's funny because I think I think digital marketing works, and digital marketing is great, but I think digital marketing only works for a product like ours if you've told the brand story multiple times.
I agree.
In Paris, we made the mistake because we just launched with digital, and I think people are méfiant to go and buy something if they don't know the story behind it.
Okay.
So now we've done old-fashioned PR in Paris, and that's worked amazingly well.
Yeah.
Same with in New York. We launched, there was a huge piece in the New York Times, like a full page, huge piece in the Wall Street Journal magazine, huge. And then a lot of really great, amazing prep, huge piece in InStyle, three pages. Then we turned on digital, and all of a sudden the digital works amazingly, because I think people are like, you know, the number of touch points, they've heard about Flowerbox, they've read about Flowerbox in a newspaper, in a magazine, and then they see the ad come up and there's a belief in the story.
So it's important to multiply the touch points.
100%. And I think people like a story. They like a person. They like to know, oh.
But what was the storytelling? It was your storytelling.
Yeah, right? Like I worked in fashion. I realized why, you know, all these reasons why this didn't exist before. And I think I was providing a solution. And I think I explained the solution in the press. And then they see the solution. And they're like, oh, yeah, it's a no-brainer.
Of course.
So I think telling the story is key.
Okay. But telling the story in newspaper, that's one thing. But telling the story to your final customer, like do you create events? Do you, because it looks like, well, talking about my experience, you've got to tell the story to every single of your customer. Because when you are another flower bouquet or another sweater or another jeans or another whatever, you are, there's so many things in the, in the, on the market. How do you make sure that everybody hears the story?
I think it's really hard to make sure everyone hears the story, especially when you're one single person and you're trying to tell the story everywhere. I think, but I do know that most of the people involved in Flower Box are behind the story. They get the story and they believe in it. Now, how I continue to tell the story and reach more people, that's a very good question. I would love your advice on that. Because it's really hard, and it's hard.
Yeah.
I know the brand is consistent in everything we do. I know the quality is consistent in everything we do, but making sure that everyone hears that story, I don't think I do that successfully, actually. I'm trying to, but I mean, I think talking to people like you, the more places you can get out there, the purpose of what you're doing, the better.
And what did you learn during this first year of business?
First of all, I learned how much hard work it is. I think there's nothing that can prepare you, which I'm sure you know now, for the amount of work. It's constant. And also the hunger for growth. So even if I'm done with my work, I'm going to give myself more work because I'm so excited by the growth and the opportunity. So it's unending, the work. I think another thing you aren't prepared for is like the highs are so high and the lows are so low. You know, the excitement when something works or something's great is so thrilling. It's like a thrill I've never known in my life, you know, career-wise. And then the lows when you don't hit a target or something doesn't work the way you want are really personal. So I think that's something, you know, a big learning in the first year.
And how do you overcome that kind of very low?
I've got an amazing family. I really do. I've got the best husband in the world who is, at the end of the day, what matters is my family. Do you know what I mean? So if ever, I mean, it's not going to fail. It can't fail. I will not let it fail. But at the end of the day, if my family's safe and they love me and I love them, then I think I'm going to be fine. You know what I mean? So I think keeping that perspective, they help me keep that perspective.
Did you regret at some point? To say, because you were...
I've never looked back, no.
Yeah?
I'm having the time of my life. No, I've never looked back.
Cool. Very happy for you. So can you explain what have been the milestones of this growth?
The milestones have been like launching new cities for me is really exciting. And New York was the biggest milestone yet because it was the biggest challenge. I have an amazing COO who's English, but he's in New York now, like has set up the operation. And getting that off the ground and making it work has been hugely exciting. I think another really great milestone and what I was hoping would happen, because you hope these things are going to happen with the business, but you really don't know what's going to happen. We have a very big B2B client. So, you know, we work with Pomelato, Vuitton, Dior, Chanel, so many great brands. And what we were hoping that as we launched in new territories, that we could become their go-to in new territories. So I think the fact that this is translating has been a huge milestone. Another really great one is the strength of the brand that we've created. We've created a really strong and identifiable brand. And what I love is when we launched in New York, the number of people that were like, we've been waiting for you. They already knew the brand. They already knew the story. So I think we've created a very desirable brand. And that's...
How did you make it? Can you give us a course of branding?
No, I've got a secret weapon husband who is, as I said, he's the creative at Tom Ford and has been forever. So he's been...
Crazy about this,
Yeah, and he's been amazing. I bounce everything off of him. Everything. Every night, poor thing, he comes home from work and I'm like, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Do you love this new layout? Do you like this newsletter? So he's very involved still in the branding.
And he's very sharp.
Yep.
Okay. So milestone, this is it. right?
Well, no, because now we're going to keep going. You know, yeah, we're going to launch in Dallas. We're going to launch in San Francisco, hopefully in Boston, in Miami. We're going to Chicago. We're going to launch across the U.S.
Okay.
I mean, I want to go to the Middle East. I want to go to China. I feel like the world is the next milestone. Not immediately.
Yeah. You want to grow very like...
I can't. My team can't listen to this. They're all going to quit.
Yeah. But you want to be... You want to become... I mean... The one and only, right? When people want to buy
chic, beautiful, consistent, amazing flowers, they go to Flower Box, and I want that name to be the name. Are you going to buy Interflora? Are you going to buy Flower Box? You know, are you going to buy flowers? Or are you going to buy Flower Box?
Mm. And how do you put this in the head of the people? Consistency, branding.
I don't know. It's funny because my friend who's the CEO of Browns, the department, you know, department store, an online department store too, she said to me she got flowers from us the other day and she said her assistant was bringing them to her and she said, oh, I got a flower box. And I'm like, yes, because it is a different experience and I want it to be a noun. It's something that's it's other than flowers. Mm. And I think brand helps you create that.
Yeah, definitely. Branding. When it comes to the technical aspects of flowers, because I mean it's like every work and every industry. You said that you went to Amsterdam and to Holland to source the flowers, but how did you get somebody at your site knowing what to talk about when it comes to flowers? Because this is kind of technical, no? It's not that easy.
Yeah, but it's not as hard as you think.
Really?
There aren't that many flowers.
Okay.
I mean, you think, like, because, you know, I didn't even know every flower.
Really?
But there aren't that many. I mean, we usually have between 30 and 40 flowers available, varieties available per season. So it's not that many to learn. Of course, there's learnings about how quickly they open. Mm. There's learnings about which ones can't stand the cold or the heat and all of that. So we have great partners in Holland that have helped, you know, as I've learned that. And I've learned through a lot of painful experience too. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I don't think it's as complicated. It's not a craft that I had to learn.
Yeah.
And I'm still not a florist.
And you will never...
No, I mean, I love flowers and I can arrange flowers in my home, but I'm not... Okay. I still can't create. Okay. I mean, I couldn't go do a wedding.
So what does your average day looks like?
There is no average day, but I usually try to get in the warehouse in the morning because flowers are really an early morning business.
So six?
No. I go at 8. I've got a team that gets there early and they're amazing. But I want to be with my children in the morning and husband. So I usually get there at 8:30, at which point usually most of the fires have been put out. Then I like to spend time with the team. It's also so vital to me that I see what's going in, what's going out. I see, you know, if you see a whole warehouse full of sky blue hydrangea, then mentally I need to see that visually because it tells the story of what people are responding to, whether they're responding, you know, what they're ordering. Are they responding to something that was posted on Instagram? Are they responding to something that was at an outdoor installation we did? You know, it's just you need to visually see it and to understand sort of what the best sellers are, what people are responding to. So I love to be there and be with the team. I'm also...
How many people is there in every platform?
So we're 35 people total.
Okay.
Yes. Most of which are in the UK. There are 4 people in Paris, six people in New York, and then the rest of the team's in Holland. Okay.
And when it comes to the headquarters, the head office, how did you get yourself surrounded? Who are the key people?
The whole team is key, honestly. No, yes. But really, we're, you know, when you're a startup and when you're small, every single person is vital, you know, and because we're a small team, the second someone is not there, you're like, you know.
Who was the very first employee you had?
The first employee was our amazing driver, James, who's very handsome. He's got a very big fan club in London and the UK and in the world. And he's very charming. Yeah. And he was the first employee. I employed him at our house around my kitchen table. And he's still, a very valued employee.
Okay. So who are the other key people?
Well, it's funny because a lot of them have left, a lot of the early key people, and that to me felt like a real failure. Yeah. I thought, how come they left? And it felt personal. But, you know, what I've learned and by listening to podcasts like yours and by, you know, speaking to so many entrepreneurs is the team that gets you from A to B is not usually the team that gets you from B to C. Mm. And the team that gets you from B to C might not be the team that's taking you all the way. So you just have to, some people you outgrow, sometimes they outgrow you. Sometimes they're not ready for the challenges that the next chapter brings. And every chapter of Flower Box has brought a whole new set of challenges. And some people are up for that challenge and some people aren't. Mm. And it's not personal. So I think it's been a big learning for me. Mm. As I said, I have an amazing COO who's based in New York, an amazing CFO who's based in London. And all of our team, our French manager is driving this French business, you know, completely on her own as a satellite office and doing an amazing job. All of our... every single person, honestly, I value tremendously.
And you yourself, how do you make sure you get ready to get from A to B and B to C and C to Z?
I'm going all the way.
Yeah.
I'm going all the way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there might come a point where I can't take it further, but at that point, you know, I hope someone buys it.
Yeah.
And takes it, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But I'll go as far as I can humanly go.
Yeah. But how can you... how do you prepare to get to get ready? I mean, how do you train yourself? How do you still learn? Because, I mean, I mean, we are all the same, you know. I mean, you had a very big job before, so you are very strong, and this is the only way to say it. You are very strong. You've got a lot of experience, but starting a business is completely different. You know, you learn so many things. You need to be good at so many things.
No, I think you also need to know what you're not good at and hire it. Do you know what I mean? I think you need to surround yourself with people who are better than you are at a lot of things. Mm. I mean, I don't need to hire someone who's good at what I'm good at. I know what I'm good at. And then I need to hire people that are great.
What are you good at?
I'm good at telling a story. I'm good at sort of the overarching vision. What I'm not as good at is the how to achieve it. Do you know, and I'm not as good as putting like structure and processes into place. But luckily, you know, the people that I mentioned are. I'm very good at selling. I think essentially I'm just a really great salesperson because I believe so thoroughly in what I'm doing. And that, so I'm very good at that. My value lies in bringing, you know, in relationships and bringing in, you know, huge clients. So I know what I'm good at. And then I'm also good at, I know where we need to go. So I'm good at providing that direction.
You are the creative director of a brand as well.
Yeah, we have a creative director.
You've got a creative director.
Yeah, I mean, the overall vision is mine and my husband's. Okay. And then we have a creative director in-house.
Okay.
Who helps us execute that vision.
How do you manage to balance your personal and professional life? You've got 3 children. You're working a lot. You've got a husband, etc. And, you know, usually people, they say, okay, yeah, I've got a balanced life. But in reality, you know, when you've got the 3 children who are screaming and you've got to cook something and your husband is not talking to you anymore because you're not here, you're not enough at home.
No, I think key is having an understanding partner. Yeah. If he weren't as excited by what we were doing, then it would not work. Mm. It's also having understanding children. I think my older children, especially if you bring them on the journey with you, I mean,
they know. Yeah.
They're 11, 9, and 3.
Yeah, it's quite
so the 11 and 9-year-old, they've watched Flower Box grow. They're really proud. They've helped me wrap flowers. They have come and loaded the van on a Saturday morning. They have been with the delivery driver out for delivery. So they are really involved in the growth. They know right now we have a bus ad on 100 buses across London for Christmas. They count how many buses they see on the way to school and they tell me, you know, at night. So they're involved in the story. And I think that's key. So then they're understanding if I had to come to Paris, they know that it's because I'm growing this brand that's for us. So I think, and then balance, I don't know. I don't think you ever achieve like perfect balance. We also are so lucky. We have a place in the country that we go to literally without fail every single weekend. It's like the non-negotiable thing that we do as a family, and that allows us to have that time to reconnect.
Where is it?
In the Cotswolds, which is like an hour and a half outside of London.
Which which one of your clients has been the most difficult to get the B2B in B2B?
The most difficult to get. Luckily, they all come on board like quite quickly.
Yeah.
Chanel, I have to say, has been a challenge, but
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's, you know, they're really demanding. And then all of our clients.
They're demanding.
Yeah. Well, they all want the best and they deserve the best. Yeah. And it's funny because I left Tom, you know, and I had one client basically who was very demanding. And now I've got like 1,000 of them, you know, and I need to know their preferences and it's very subjective flowers. And some people think purple hydrangea are beautiful and some people think they're awful and it's so personal. Yeah. You know, so it's really understanding and listening to taste and preference.
And how do you put your feet into the door when you are approaching a client?
Well, I listen to Beyonce on the way to the meeting. Then I get really pumped up. I really do. Before my biggest pitches, I listen to Beyonce. Yeah. Okay. Or Cardi B, Money. I listen to that song too a lot. I get my hustle on. I honestly really believe in what we're doing. So it's not, I don't feel like I'm selling, like trying to get, like to hoodwink people. I'm just telling them the truth. Mm. We're providing fresher flowers. We're providing great value. We have great taste. We are creating, you know what I mean?
We're the best.
Yeah, but I believe it.
Of course. Except Tom Ford, what has been your other mentor?
Tom has been my greatest mentor. Natalie Massenet and Carmen Bousquet have been great mentors to me. A woman called Chrissy Wheeler, who owns The White Company, which is a huge company in the UK. Huge. She has been a really great mentor to me. I'm lucky. I'm surrounded by really strong women who are, you know, great role models. They're great at asking, you know, answering questions, helping me sort of navigate this.
And it's difficult to say it like that, but how do you use them? It's not the right word, but how do you approach them each time you've got a problem? I'm sure they are very understanding and you are very close to them, but at some point, you know, we all have a lot of mentors around us, and for myself this is the case, but how do you present your problem and when do you decide to call them or not? Because sometimes you can find the solution by yourself, and sometimes it's good to find the solution by itself. But talking to people, it helps you to open your mind and to think differently and think outside the box and get the experience from those people.
I think you ask the people closest to you, and I'm lucky I've got a very strong senior management team. I think we try to solve it in that way. Mm. I speak to my husband about it. I think having great people around you in the everyday, and then I think if you can't answer it then and have come up to a brick wall, that's where I use sort of our board and I use the secret mentors event that I've mentioned. Yeah. Mm. I do try to answer it internally first, and I do sit on it. I think sitting on something is essential. Mm. You know, for a few days or a week to just really make sure you can't figure it out yourself. Because back to what you say, sometimes it's really better to come to the, you know, find the answer yourself.
Mm. And what has been your biggest fail so far?
Failure is, well, I think the biggest challenge has been team. Because back to my previous point, it does feel like a failure when someone's not happy or someone doesn't want to work with you. Do you know what I mean? So it feels personal and it feels like a failure, but I've come to learn that that's, you know, it's not a failure. I think it is the biggest challenge is getting the team perfect and right for where you are right now.
And do you have any tips for that to build the perfect team and to keep the people? Well, you talk about it earlier, but how to find the right people?
Well, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure in the past I've always found the right people. What I think we're doing now and is a very good exercise is defining our company values. Like, what do we stand for? And I think for me, I had never done that. And it was so obvious to me what we stood for. But what wasn't clear to me is that it wasn't obvious for everyone on the team what we stand for.
What do you stand for?
So I think creating very strong company values is key. Because then when you can use it as a tool when you're interviewing people. This is what we stand for. This is what we expect.
What the specific values of Flowerbox?
So quality is a key value. Sort of delivery. Because delivery is key, you know, delivery internally to our teams, delivery externally to people, like delivering in general on what we're meant to deliver, delivering on deadlines, delivery. Data, using being data driven. So not making decisions based on, oh, does that look nice? You know, we have to be data driven and data focused. And we also have to be responsible. So I think responsibility to the environment, responsibility to each other, you know, building a culture of responsibility for our future. So those are the key values that we've pulled out in this exercise.
When it comes to responsibility, because I'm sure this is a big subject in your company, as it is in food, as it is in fashion. I mean, the flower business, there is a big dark side as well, we've got to say. I understood recently that there's a lot of things going wrong in the flower. How do you tackle this? How do you make sure that this is sourced appropriately? You respect the seasons. You respect. You avoid your flowers to take the plan from the South Africa or the other side of the world.
Okay, I think like the fashion industry and like the food industry, that you can't be 100% perfect. And I think that's also where people go wrong, is because they're not trying to start. So what we have started with is we compost all of our green waste in every single market. So that's key. So all of our events that, you know, the flowers that come back from events, they're composted. So that is one thing. They're not going into a bin. We also have no stock. So the fact that we have this inventory-less model is actually very green, because most florists waste up to 60% of the flowers, like the food industry. You know, it's a perishable good. So it goes in a landfill. We have no waste, so that already makes us greener. I'm not claiming that we're perfect, and there's a lot of work to do on it. We have no plastic in our packaging, which has been a very difficult decision because flowers are wet. So plastic is obviously the easiest way, you know. And
so
all,
what do you use?
We have, everything's paper. So we're also working, at the beginning of next year, we'll have all biodegradable packaging, which is obviously at a huge cost, but it's important. And that goes back to the values. If you define what is important, and that, then you have to work towards that, and everyone knows what they're working towards. So those are steps we've taken, and we will continue to make, you know, steps towards more responsibility. Right.
But does your client ask for that?
No.
Not yet.
Well, I don't think, I don't know. I'm so much our client. I so understand our client that I want that. So I know that, I'm not sure anyone specifically asked for that, but we've never done otherwise.
But maybe because when you look at flowers, this is so beautiful and so amazing and so refreshing and so fresh. You don't imagine how much maybe pesticides or how much wrong thing there is about flowers. Isn't it?
Yeah, I don't. But I do think people, we all know that the world is becoming more aware of, you know, what they're doing and the impact it has on the world. So I do think it's a question they will start asking more, and we need to be able to answer.
Why do you think, I think this is a question you everybody ask you, but so you are an online business. When you've got Amazon, who are very good at delivering everything all over the world in 12 hours, how do you compete with that kind of people?
Oh, I don't think we're competing with that kind of people. And I decided early on that we are a luxury brand, and no luxury brand competes with Amazon. And for me, quality is way more important than speed. Speed and efficiency are important, but the beauty and the quality of the product's more important. So I'm not really competing with Amazon.
They're not good at making quality. They will never be able to make quality, you think?
I don't know. I don't think flowers are... you don't need flowers the way you need batteries. I think you put more thought into like planning the flowers that you're going to buy. So I'm not, I have no idea if Amazon can deliver luxury. That is like a whole nother question.
This is the same question for Net-a-Porter or for Matches Fashion or for whatever, whoever is doing luxury business. I mean, the only way to avoid Amazon to take your business is the branding and the quality and the service, right?
I think the human element too. Yeah. You know, we're an online business, but I think 19-20% of our customers, they just want to talk about it. They want someone at the end of the phone that can say, oh, the peonies have just come back in season. They're especially beautiful now. And the, you know, so I think the human element is key too.
Yeah.
Also, I think advising people. So we have a whole editorial element to our site where you're inspiring people and you're giving them, you're not saying here are your batteries. You're saying, here are these flowers. They're back in season. This is what you can do with them on your dining table. This is how so-and-so likes to use her flowers. These are how, you know, Dior did their use these flowers at an event recently. So you tell a story where I think people want to be educated and they want an editorial, you know, some editorial context, which I think, you know, Matches does really well. They tell the whole story of the, so you're buying into the story too.
But how did you organize yourself to, for the editorial part? Because, I mean, it cost a fortune, well, maybe not, but it costs a lot of money. How do you monitor the return on investment of the editorial part of your website?
That's a really good question. And I don't think that's, I don't think I want to see a direct ROI from an editorial, the editorial section. I don't see conversion immediately from it. What I do know is when I'm out and about what people respond to and why they love the brand. And the reason they love the brand is because of those stories, you know, because we're inspiring people. So I think it's important and I think it's intangible and I don't think it's quantifiable, but I do think that's definitely, that definitely creates the magic. You know, the same way for me, you go to a Chanel haute couture show and that's the magic of Chanel. And then you're selling lipsticks to people all over the world. So what I want to do is create the magic. And I don't think the magic you can necessarily quantify.
Will you sell something something different than flower at some point?
Oh, yeah. We sell vases. We have multiple vase ranges. We have floral scissors. And definitely, I think anything... And people, you know, they're always one of our best sellers every week is, is the vases or the scissors. Yeah.
Wow.
So I think people believe in us as how to, you know, as taste makers. So I think we
Will you expand to ever decorating things?
I don't know. I think right now the focus is on things related to flowers.
Of course.
But that's not to say...
Candles, that kind of things.
No, we have candles and candles room spray. They're beautiful. There it is right there. Here, I'm going to show you. And it smells very good.
Great. Okay.
And our chic candle.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm gonna become a client now, you know?
Good. I love it. I love it. I told you I'm a salesperson.
Definitely. Okay. Would you do anything differently? You don't look back, but come on.
I would do things differently, but I think all the things I did got us to where we are now. So I think some of the failures were necessary. There's not one thing specifically I would do differently. I don't think I would have. No, I don't think I would have done anything differently. Sure, there, you know, I've made mistakes for sure. But I think all the mistakes have been sort of necessary part of this process.
But would you have stayed... 20 years if you could make it again?
Yes, I would, because I had to be ready, and I wouldn't have been ready had I done it 5 years before.
Of course.
And I wouldn't have had the amazing relationships I had. I wouldn't have had the time I had with my little children when they're, you know, so I think it was all meant to be.
Perfect. Okay. It's been an hour. We've been together already.
Wow. Time flies when you're having fun.
All right. My last question usually is: if you had the chance to whisper mm-hmm. Whitney something in her ears when she was 18 years old, and was going to go back to the US because she was broke and couldn't stay in France anymore, what would you tell her?
I believe in yourself. I think, like, have confidence. Which, of course, I didn't at 18, but no one does, you know, or 22.
Something we didn't talk about is about being a woman as an entrepreneur woman. Maybe this is not a subject for you, but right now in France, this is a subject.
Oh, I think it's a huge subject.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the fact that 5% of capital goes to female founders is astonishing. I'm so lucky that my investors are for the most part women and that I've been surrounded by very strong women. Mm. So I haven't encountered that, but I have been talking to a lot of institutional funds for the next funding round that we'll do. And when you walk into a room full of 15 men who are making decisions, you know, they're not running households. Usually they're not the ones who are dealing with so-and-so's birthday flowers or so-and-so's thank you for dinner, or they're not the ones organizing, you know, the food in the house. So they don't see, they don't get the value in the solution because they're not running the house. You look to, you know, to a woman who's running a household in a certain way and she gets it immediately and it's a solution. So I think until we have more females in those VC roles, you know, deciding where money is going to go, that there's going to be a huge, you know, a problem. Mm.
And how can we change this?
I think there are a lot of great funds now that are backing female founders. I think that's a great start. Mm. I think I feel a responsibility as a female entrepreneur to, it's my mission to go out and inspire young girls and inspire people to, inspire women to make that change.
And how can you do that as a man?
I think giving more women senior management roles, letting women be part of, like, you know, the number of women that don't have, you know, that don't have key senior management roles is astonishing. I think having flexible maternity situations, because so many of women drop out of the workforce at 30, 35 before they've reached their potential because, you know, they're having babies. So I think the whole system has to change, really. Mm. But I do feel a responsibility as a female founder to start small and make my change where I am. Mm. And I think big corporations have a huge responsibility to do that.
Definitely. Of course. And who is going to take to buy you at some point?
LVMH, if you're listening. I think a luxury brand, I think it would be nice for a luxury brand to have us in their portfolio, especially because we work for all of the brands in their portfolio. So I think, you know, a big luxury conglomerate like that would be great. I think a huge flower player would be great. You know, someone who...
Interflora.
Yeah, Interflora, who wanted the brand.
Yeah.
You know, they have the have a lot of the logistics sewn up.
But if you sell it, what would you do?
I don't know. I'd have to do it again.
Yeah.
I'd have to do something else. Yeah. You couldn't go from the amazing adrenaline roller coaster that I've been on for the past 4 years to doing nothing. Yeah. So I think I'd start again.
What will you do?
No idea.
Chocolate or food? No. Flowers? Fashion?
I don't know.
A restaurant?
I don't know.
A hotel?
Who knows?
Yeah, of course. All right, last question. Who would you like to listen to in this podcast?
Well, I think we just said Carmen Bousquet. I would love to listen to her. Yeah. And you'll love speaking to her.
Definitely. And she's quite often in Paris, I think, no?
She's often. She has a house here. She's in Paris a lot.
Perfect. Okay.
Carmen. Also, do you know Julie de Libron?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
She would be great. She's launching the most amazing. She's launched the most amazing. It's called Dress by Julie.
Yeah.
And it's all about sort of slow fashion.
Perfect.
And true luxury, and she's lovely and chic and beautiful and very smart, so I would love to listen to her.
Perfect.
Hi,
thank
Julie.
You. Thank you so much, Whitney.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Entreprendre dans la mode. If you like the episode, please send a message to my guest to thank them for their generosity. If you want to support Entreprendre dans la mode, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you follow. Just click on the subscribe button, rate it 5 stars, and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts. To not miss any news, follow me on Instagram or Twitter. Thank you for listening to Entreprendre dans la mode, and see you next week for a new episode.